Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by conservative Dan Propp, liberal John McCarron, and Charles Ipsen from the University of Chicago. Our program coming to you tonight from the brand new Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289, our email address, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. We have in-studio guests. You will hear from Charles, Dan, and John in just a few moments. But first, we're going to switch gears and go directly to Joplin, Missouri, where Joe Lancello is standing by. Joe is an anchor for KZRG in Joplin, Missouri, one of the stations on the Great Zimmer Network. And Joe has been covering the devastation in his backyard. President Obama was there this afternoon. Joe, welcome to Beyond the Beltway. Tell us a little bit about what happened today with the president and Governor Nixon of Missouri.
Well, today, Bruce, thank you very much for having me on. It was, it almost seemed more like a pep rally, at least as far as the president himself was concerned. Almost like the people that were there to see a rock star. And there was, I know Josh Marsh, our news director, was there with me, and he noted that there was somebody in the crowd who yelled, "We love you, Obama!" And it would have been a great chance for the president to say, "This isn't about me. This is about you guys." He chose not to do that. So, I thought Governor Nixon's speech was a little more inspiring and reached more, I guess, if we want to go by the standard of did he hit a home run or this or that. I thought Nixon had a triple and Obama somewhere between first and second.
The published reports indicate that there was a warm reception, however, in a very conservative part of Missouri. Was the reception at least warm and comforting on the part of the people?
Oh yes, very polite, standing ovation, what you would expect for a president, absolutely.
When something, by the way, we should mention, when something like this happens, that something of this level has not happened. I mean, this is one of the great tragedies of the last 50 years in the country. What impact is it having instantly in that community with the people that you deal with on a daily basis, both on the air and when you go home from work?
Well, there was a lot of shock, certainly, at first. I mean, when you first saw what we're able to see the daylight come Monday morning of what happened, it was like, wow, because a lot of areas look like, I mean, you've probably seen the video of St. John's Hospital look like it was bombed.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of things just on streets going in, there are just a lot of things that, you know, you just remember the local landmarks like the bike shop here or the place where I get my hair cut. Those things aren't there anymore, and there's hardly any trace of anything that would let you know that there had been anything there.
One thing that the president had to say today to the crowd, he said, "I promise you your country will be there with you every single step of the way," a pledge he extended to all parts of the nation racked by violent storms just in recent months. Dan Propft is in studio with us. Dan, how much can a country do and how much should a country do when something like this hits a particular region, because it seems to me that it's happening every single month. We're dealing with another story like this somewhere in this country.
Well, I mean, look, that's where what the country can do is provide federal support for and even local support for rebuilding. We saw it in Katrina. We've seen it with last year with the floods in Iowa. And now, of course, this tragedy. So, I mean, I think that's where the country can step in. And usually the great thing about America is we do step in when devastation hits any part of our country.
As a conservative, what's your perspective? What is the role of government in a situation like this?
Well, look, we have the resources that we have, the federal disaster relief that we have. That's maybe one of the few core missions of government is a centralized government is to provide for that relief with the idea that states send tax money to the federal government for instances such as this.
John McCarron is our liberal tonight. John, your reaction to the same question, and you agree that this thing is happening more and more and more, where weather is the lead story in the country.
Well, it is, and the scientists are telling us that one thing we can expect with global warming is there's going to be these more violent sort of episodic rain and frontal storms during the summer months, and maybe we're beginning to see that. Maybe not. Maybe this is just a throw of the dice. Well, what really hits you is how random it all is. I mean, a storm came through the Chicago area this afternoon, and I was sort of glued to the Doppler radar. After seeing what happened in Joplin and down in Alabama,
Charles, you hail from Marks, Mississippi, so you hail from a small town in the South. Religion is such an integral part of life, not only in Mississippi, but in this part of Missouri or in many parts of Missouri. Where does faith come in to one's dealing with a situation like this? I want to get your reaction and then to Joe's response.
Faith plays two roles. One is it's a great comfort to the people to be able not only to speak directly to their God, but to be together with their fellow congregants. Maybe they're meeting in a tent. Maybe they're meeting outdoors. But that helps. And it plays another role in it's related to something that Dan was saying, which is collective rebuilding. People are more likely to stay, more likely to help each other rebuild when they have strong ties to the community.
Joe, what is the depth of religious belief in the community that you cover?
I think there's quite a bit of that around here. I've worked in a few different states, and this is the first place I've been where they have prayers before government meetings like city council and things like that. So it certainly is a very big part of the community.
You know, until 1927, the great Mississippi River flood, there was no federal relief at all for any disasters. So it's still relatively recent. It's less than 100 years old. And what we know from these big disasters, hurricanes in South Florida and so forth, is ultimately on the order of 40 to 50% of the total funding for rebuilding, but not more than that, ends up coming from the federal government. So a lot of it ends up coming from people who are insured or people deciding to draw on their savings, but it's not totally compensated for.
We should mention over 120 known dead at the moment, 105 missing. They discovered about 1,300 in the last 72 hours. The number of injured is massive, certainly. I don't even think anybody has been able to put a dollar figure on what the property devastation is in the area. I want to open up the phone lines to people listening around the country. 1-800-723-8289. I want to get your reaction. Again, this is such a common story that we're dealing with in this country. The devastation of Americans going through horrible times. What is your reaction? What is the government's reaction? How should we react when stories like this are devastating the lives of Americans? We'll be back to hear more from Joe, who is on the scene in Joplin, Missouri, when we continue tonight on Beyond the Beltway. Bruce Dumont back, 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. I want to go back to Joe Lancello, who is with KZRG in Joplin, Missouri. He's a news anchor in the afternoon in that market. Let's talk about the rebuilding effort. How is it being organized on the ground, Joe?
Well, I just want to update some numbers, Bruce, that we had a news conference about an hour and a half ago. The number of missing people now stands at 43.
43, okay.
That's still unaccounted for as far as those killed. There's a little discrepancy now. The city of Joplin is going with 139. The state of Missouri says 126.
Okay.
Why there's a difference, I don't know there.
That's a number dead?
Yes.
Number of victims. And again, the ability to organize or the organizational structure, I mean, who basically is in charge? How is that being handled on the ground?
Well, I know. I can tell you that Walmart had lost their one of their stores here. They say they are going to rebuild. Home Depot lost a store. I believe they also plan to rebuild. There was a supermarket chain, Dillon's. They are also saying that they are going to rebuild. As far as the actual structure, I would imagine it just as it is for any other building project, and people are going to try to expedite things as much as possible because they do want to get going. Something Mayor Mike Wilson said this afternoon at a gathering to mark the one-week anniversary, if you will, is that the real story is you, the citizens of Joplin. You are the future as we rebuild. And everybody is just so determined to get everything cleaned up and to rebuild. And Mark Rohr, the city manager, said earlier in the week he really wants people to stay in Joplin. And there are concerns that this would cause some people to leave the area.
But when the president was there today, did he specifically talk about the process? In other words, does one go down to where the local post office used to be, and do you fill out forms to get federal aid? Does the state of Missouri have a similar office? I mean, from a very practical way, I mean, how do you go about seeking help? Because obviously it's going to be a federal disaster area, but how do you go about just the mechanics of filling out the forms?
He really did not mention that at all today. It almost seems throughout the course of the week that it's almost been an infomercial for FEMA, because we've heard that so much from city officials and so on. Call FEMA, make sure you get on the list. Contact the Small Business Administration about a loan or possible assistance. Even if your business wasn't affected, you might find out a couple months down the line that it really was affected.
I want to get some – this is Charles Lipson. I want to get a few basic pieces of data that seem to be bypassed in a lot of the news. How big is Joplin?
About 50,000.
And how – were any of the schools destroyed?
Oh, yes. The high school, two elementary schools, and I believe the central administrative building. Those are completely gone. A couple other buildings also had a good chunk of damage.
For those listening around the country, place it on the map. Where is it in the state of Missouri, and what surrounds it? What are some national, perhaps, land points, landmarks that people listening around the country would understand?
We're in southwest Missouri. We call the area the Four States because we are very close to the borders of Kansas and Oklahoma. Arkansas may be about an hour to the south, but
so when people think of that, when people think of that tornado alley through Kansas and Oklahoma, you're really part of that.
Oh, absolutely! Newton and Jasper counties, where Joplin is located, that's another little quirk. We're in two counties. Those two counties have the most tornadoes of any counties in the state of Missouri.
Well, if I could give you one piece of unsolicited advice, it would be to talk to Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi. He did the best job of anybody in terms of managing reconstruction after Katrina. There was just a disaster. You know, it hit not New Orleans. It hit dead on in southern Mississippi.
Gulf Coast, yeah.
And there was a bipartisan effort. He appointed one of his chief political foes, actually, and worked very closely with him. And they were very successful in dealing with towns that were completely wiped off the map.
Now, after Katrina, obviously, the president went to New Orleans. He made similar statements, as did President Obama today, that the United States government, the country, was going to be there. We would not forget what happened in Katrina. And yet, several years later, there was great criticism that the government didn't do as much, or there was too much confusion and skullduggery and mismanagement at the local level. Does the post-Obama remarks today, I'll ask you this question to you, Joe, do the post-Obama remarks today raise a level of expectation and demanded competence on the part of the Obama administration? Because, again, we are away, you know, we're just a little over a year away from voting again.
Well, right now it seems like people are just pretty much determined to pick things up and kind of pick themselves up and go back on. It's interesting that Governor Nixon is dedicating $25 million of next year's budget. He announced that late in the week, that toward relief for Joplin. And he had, has also donated a similar amount for the areas in southeastern Missouri that's been dealing with flooding. So if you were a little cynical, you could say that maybe he's trying to buy himself some support in this region of the state.
John McCarron.
Well, I think one problem George Bush had in New Orleans is that he had at the time as the head of FEMA, the infamous "You're doing a good job, Brownie," whose last gig was as the president of the Arabian Horse Breeding Society. So I guess he ingratiated himself to the swells who happened to own Arabian horses, but I don't know, not sure what he was doing as head of FEMA. So
and let's just add that the mayor of the city of New Orleans and the governor of the state couldn't have been less competent.
No, but the question that I have now is: does the president have the ability to basically wow the people of Joplin with how his federal government reacts to this? It seems to mean you're dealing in a very politically conservative area of the state. I mean. And again, we do talk about politics on this program. Does his ability to deal with this, does that affect where Missouri goes in a presidential election if he does a terrific job in helping Joplin out? Dan Kraft?
Well, I mean, I think the response to catastrophes that capture the nation's attention have political impact. There's no doubt about it. And, I don't know specifically. I know the president referenced calling FEMA. I know there's been some FEMA response. But in terms of are there actual boots on the ground from the federal government helping people to process the support that they can get?
Let's go to Will listening to us in Elgin, Texas on KLBJ. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Bruce. Just a quick rundown. I have been working federal disasters in the state of Texas since beginning with Rita.
Mm-hmm.
And the way people apply for assistance, FEMA comes in and state joins with them and sets up what's called a disaster recovery center. And they publicize radio, newspaper, television, every way they can to let people know FEMA's in town. Come in and apply for assistance.
What kind of assistance do you get?
This was individual assistance. Anybody who's lost their home, lost their car.
So if I lost my home and I go in and I apply, let's say my home was worth $150,000 and now I don't have any place to live and I lost my car too and it was worth $15,000. What am I applying for? How much subsidy is involved? How much is it a loan?
I'll let the experts tell you about the amounts because that's not something I'm working mm-hmm. with. But they would apply for housing assistance, and that could take the form of either renter's assistance, rental assistance, or just help them find a place to live until they can get back in their home.
But in the case, let me ask, stay on the line, but Joe, in this particular case, if someone who's lost a home wants to rent, I mean, it's not like there's a lot of vacant rental property in Joplin, is there?
Right. There's being scooped up really quickly. I'm finding that out myself. My place has been condemned, and there are about eight of us here at the station of Zimmer Radio that have had that happen. So we've been finding out real quick.
Now, will there be, let me ask this question to Will. Will, as part of this, I mean, are they sending in, prefab homes or trailers? Is that part of this process that happens immediately when a disaster like this strikes?
They are discussing it. They're trying to get away from the travel trailers that were so common during Rita and Katrina. They're using prefabricated homes. That's something that's coming into its own.
Right.
They have to be mobile. They tend to take them to the individual's property to get them right next door to where they're trying to rebuild.
And in a situation like this where you have FEMA coming in, this was the question I asked before, does FEMA supersede the state authorities? How does it interact with the Red Cross, the Salvation Army, and other organizations that you suspect to be on the scene of a disaster like this? Who is in charge? Who is giving orders to whom, Will?
There is always a federal disaster person in charge, and that usually will be a FEMA person, but there are different phases.
Right.
Red Cross and Salvation Army come in during the response phase.
Joe, has there been good law and order?
Been a few problems with looters, but not too terribly many. It seems like the police and county sheriff's office have been doing a nice job. They've also had the Missouri National Guard. We've had law enforcement from a lot of other communities in the area come in, too, to help with that.
Joe Lancello, listen, I thank you very much for your eyewitness report tonight. This is Joe Lancello, afternoon news anchor on KZRG in Joplin, Missouri. That's one of the Zimmer Radio Group. And, Will, thank you very much for offering your insight. If there's anybody listening to the broadcast this evening that has gone in and filled out a FEMA report form in a previous disaster, take us through the process. I think everybody listening to the broadcast this evening would like to know how the process works. Back shortly from Chicago. From Burlington, Iowa to Burlington, Vermont, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. Charles Ipsen from the University of Chicago is here. He is a longtime political scientist for that great institution. John McCarron is here. He is our liberal. He is a adjunct professor at DePaul University. He spent over 27 years with the Chicago Tribune as a writer, a columnist, and also a member of their editorial board. Conservative commentator Dan Proft joins us from our flagship station, WLS Radio, where he hosts his own show with Bruce Wolf. And before we get on to a discussion of national politics, let me mention for those listening to us on WLS Radio, you perhaps have heard the news by now, but Tom Roser has passed away. We talked about Tom's retirement on this program last week when he announced his retirement, and unfortunately he passed away last evening. And in the second hour of our broadcast this evening, in the last half hour, we will be talking about Tom Roser, a good friend of yours truly, and Dan Proft, and an inspiration to many listeners and from coast to coast, really. And we'll talk more about Tom Roser and his passing in that part of our broadcast this evening. One thing that I know that Tom would be chomping at the bit to talk about this evening is this presidential race that is unfolding with no clear front runner. The odd things is that two of the three people who have done best in the most recent polls are two people that are not likely to run. One is Rudy Giuliani, who is running first in one poll. Again, name recognition, but don't hold your breath for Rudy Giuliani getting in or winning. And a point behind is Mitt Romney, who would like to be president. And then you have Sarah Palin, who is embarked today on a bus tour around the country, starting in New Hampshire, with getting a boost from Rolling Thunder this afternoon. Dan Proft, you're a card-carrying conservative Republican of this field. We should also mention it's a week that Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota, former governor of Minnesota, got into the race. And yet he's had a hard time even getting a lot of publicity even in that week. Seems to be upstaged by Sarah Palin, who seems to have a knack for upstaging anybody she wants whenever she wants to do it. And the national media loves her, but do you think she will run?
I'm not convinced she will. I know this tour that she's doing, particularly when it gets to the Northeast, a place she doesn't particularly like to go, a place she has problems, will be interesting to see what the response is. I think she has a lot of, I like her, but I think she has a lot of rebranding work to do if she's going to be viable. And I'm just not sure that this isn't just an opportunity to continue to leverage her celebrity for other pursuits in the media and elsewhere. So I know John Fund of the Wall Street Journal suggests that she won't run. So there's this dance, and we just went through this dance with Mitch Daniels. So it will be very interesting to see play out, but I'm not convinced she's going to run.
Andrew Sullivan said on Chris Matthews' show today that he thinks that Sarah Palin could beat Barack Obama. John, do you agree with that?
No, I don't think he could. Barack Obama... right now, at least when he puts on his political face, he's got to be a pretty happy guy. I mean, to see these various candidates kind of fainting in and then fainting out. And it just looks to me like, they say Sarah Palin isn't running yet, but I saw her on TV today at that motorcycle rally. And there she was. She was saying, oh, no, I'm not running. I'm here to support the veterans. And right behind her was an aide who had a large sign that said SarahForVets.com or something. I heard her latest, her website of du jour. So she looks like she's running to me.
Titillating or serious in your view, Professor?
It's hard to know, but I think that she would not be able to win in a national contest. And the reason is that...
She won a Republican primary.
She might be able to, especially given how weak the field is. I actually think that John was right when he was saying how Barack has to be smiling. He has to be smiling for two reasons. One is that I think that Sarah Palin draws all the oxygen out of the room from any of the other candidates. And the other is that in a race that looked as if it was all going to be about Obama, did you want him or did you think that he was doing a poor job, now they've managed with Paul Ryan to put the Republicans on the defensive.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. This conventional wisdom is that's being promulgated here is, right, that almost anybody can beat Barack Obama except everybody running in the Republican field. I think Sarah Palin could win a Republican primary. I think she's formidable, and I think it's a mistake to underestimate her, as the Republican establishment in Alaska had to learn the hard way. And I also think that she could beat Barack Obama. I think the Republican challenge, to Charles's point, is to make sure that this election is what most elections are, which is a referendum on the incumbent, and that at the national level they can't do what they did in New York 26, that special election, which is to make it a referendum on, you know, the Paul Ryan plan and just be able to leverage their kind of Metascare demagoguery about the Paul Ryan plan in the absence of a plan of their own.
But if it worked in New York, could it work elsewhere on the congressional level, not necessarily the presidential level? Is that a template that can be used successfully?
No, I don't think it is a template, and I think that people are overreading the implications of that race. You had a third-party candidate who tried to adopt the Tea Party banner that pulled votes from the Republican, and you didn't necessarily have the most talented communicator as the Republican nominee. Look, Pete Sessions, the chairman of the NRCC, is targeting 16 seats for pickup. In the Senate, you have I think more than 2.5 times as many Democrat incumbents up as Republicans. So the numbers look pretty good for Republicans at least to maintain control and probably take control of the Senate if it's not a catastrophe at the national level.
But it's not a strong presidential list.
Yeah, but you know, that's this is.
But, I want to challenge that. Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Me too.
That is the conventional wisdom of the professors and also of the pundits.
The mudslinging begins.
But when you win a nomination, no matter what your background is, you suddenly become very well known, liked or disliked, and you become presidential as you go towards election day. So I'm looking back in 1992 when the big name Democrats all decided to take a pass because George Bush was at about 89%. And they were referred to as the seven dwarfs. One of the seven dwarfs was a governor from Arkansas, Bill Clinton. And the rest of that field, again, people were saying the same things about this field. So I'm just saying is you have a former governor of Missouri, of Minnesota, a former governor of Alaska. You have a former governor of Massachusetts. You have a former U.S. ambassador. I mean, what makes these people lightweights?
I'm not saying they're lightweights. I think
You're saying they're not serious.
No, I didn't say that either. I didn't think it was the strongest field. Actually, I think that the strongest candidate would have been Mitch Daniels. I think that the likely nominee, you don't know, the likely nominee could be Romney, and I think that the problem that Romney will have two problems. One is that he does not fire up a lot of the base. The base has been all about fiscal conservatism and with a fair amount of social conservatism, and I think that they have real questions about him. And I think that
if the base is split three ways, doesn't he sneak in?
Well, he goes in kind of weak. John. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I agree with the professor that...
I'm now the professor? Lord.
We have the professor in the pundits.
The governor of Indiana would have made a fine candidate.
I Why?
Mean, but the, because I'm a wonk and he's a good administrator. I mean, he's done a lot of right things, privatizing the Indiana toll road. He's made a lot of... I mean, they're running it.
Romney did not.
Mitch Daniels, just a real solid administrator, and even though he's not very telegenic, I think he would have made a good president. But what I really wanted to contribute here. The biggest problem for the Republicans is they're being driven so far to the right in order to be competitive in the primary. I mean, you got to sign on to Grover Norquist's anti-tax pledge. You got to sign on to Congressman Ryan's Medicare voucher program. I mean, to even have a chance in the primary, and that's just not where the nation is now.
Well, the nation is certainly not in the mood for more tax increases, so I don't think that's moving far to the right at all.
I don't think you're giving the nation enough credit.
I think I am. It's just the nation is not reflective of your kind of big government tax and spend liberalism, which is what we've had for the last, actually, frankly, to some extent under the last couple of years of Bush and certainly under the 2-year disaster of this president. You know, the weak field argument, too, this reminds me, and Stephen Hayward had a piece in National Review this week about that. You know, this is the same thing they were saying about the field in 1980. Jimmy Carter, 18 months out of that election, was in a lot stronger position than Barack Obama.
Open for Reagan.
Reagan had. Reagan's a lightweight. George H.W. Bush is a lightweight. These are weak candidates. They don't have the stature. They're not going to compete. And, of course, a lot of things change in 18 months. The elections are referendums on the incumbent. Barack Obama is the incumbent. And if the economy is where it is now, he is going to have a lot of explaining to do. For the first time in his life, he's actually going to have a record he has to defend.
A new name has popped up this past week. After saying that he wasn't interested, he's certainly sending signals now that he might be interested. And that is the governor of Texas, Rick Perry. Everybody listening on KLBJ, I want you to go to your phones because I want to get your reaction to your governor giving some thought now, supposedly seriously, according at least to some of the Sunday morning shows, about jumping into this race at a time when a lot of professionals say, oh, we don't want another Republican governor from Texas. You have to look at Texas as one of the strongest Republican states. He's been a good governor, at least as far as some of the national media coverage is concerned. I want to get your reaction. He was challenged in a primary, but he beat Kay Bailey Hutchinson. I want to get your reaction. 1-800-723-8289. Will America and will the Republican Party, or could the party, once again turn to Texas for their standard bearer next year? 1-800-723-8289. From Mount Vernon, Texas to Sugar Land, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. I have touched the nerve for the folks listening to us in the Lone Star State. They all want to talk about their governor and whether or not it would be wise for him to seek the Republican nomination. Let's go to Kurt, listening to us in Austin on KLBJ. Go ahead. Are you there? Well, I guess Kurt's not that exciting about it. How about Horseshoe Bay, Texas, where Macon is listening? Go ahead.
Yes, sir.
What do you think of your governor running for president?
Well, I really am surprised. I didn't think you would want to step down and take a lesser position. Texas was a country before it was a state, so he's kind of the president of the country right now. But if he did, I think he would make a very fine president.
What has made him a good governor? For those around the country that don't know much about him, tell us why he is a good governor.
Conservative values, physically responsible. He cares about his state, and he cares about his country.
Okay.
Well, I'll tell you, the interesting thing about Rick Perry, one is a kind of a Reagan-esque story in terms of he was a Democrat who switched over and became a Republican and became a very conservative one and now the longest-serving governor of Texas. The other thing to this whole narrative of, oh, no, not another governor from Texas and the country's fatigue with that, this is a guy who you just mentioned, Bruce, before the break. He took on the Bush establishment because it was the Bush establishment who backed Kay Bailey Hutchinson in a primary against him, and he defeated her. So, not all Texas governors are created equally, and I think you have to judge Rick Perry on his own merits.
Why did Hutchinson think he was vulnerable? I mean, she turned out to be wrong, but what did she think his vulnerability was?
Well, I don't know the particulars of Texas politics like Illinois, but the sense was that Perry was a little bit vulnerable for some of the comments he made. There were some questions about some personal land deals where he benefited, one of the comments was that he kind of famously still takes heat for is the idea of potentially seceding from the union, which is kind of problematic for a governor to say.
Hadn't we tried that once?
Yeah, but But again, I think this was just something where there was establishment fatigue with him because he's not one of theirs. And frankly, that's a pretty good narrative to spin at the national level of not being one of the establishments, whether it's a Republican or Democrat establishment.
Well, Kenny Rahmeyer from KLBJ, who precedes us and follows us every Sunday night, I'm sure he's going to be talking about it. If he wants to give us a call, give us a call. But Michael is listening to us this evening on KLBJ, going coast to coast from Austin, Texas. Your take on Governor Perry?
Well, my whole thought on the matter is, of all these candidates, which one can win the states that George Bush did and win the Electoral College? And I could see Palin losing, you know, a Missouri, a Ohio, or a Michigan. But as it stands now, I think Rick Perry might be the only guy that could defend or repeat the Bush strategy as far as Electoral College and winning by the skin of his teeth.
Would you put Mitt Romney in that category as well?
I'm afraid he would lose a Florida or a Nevada. And, I mean, and same with Palin might, you know, would lose an upper, a Midwestern state. I mean, I see Rick Perry as the only guy of this field of candidates is sort of defending that plan on the Electoral College. We're not going to win California. He's not, you know, and but he might get some of those Rust Belt states.
Well, I think you may be right about Perry, and I think the concerns you raise about the other candidates with particular states is a legitimate concern. Tim Pawlenty, pretty successful Midwestern governor, I think could also potentially follow that lead. I don't think President Obama is going to win North Carolina again. I don't think he's going to win Indiana again. And I think Pawlenty is somebody who maybe could be, win Pennsylvania in addition to Ohio, in addition
Florida
to Michigan.
Florida is crucial, don't you think, for both of you, John and
Sure. Sure, Florida is crucial, but I don't see any kind of inherent flaw that Pawlenty has.
No, I wasn't saying that there was. I was just wondering,
that's why Medicare is kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Well, you say that Florida is crucial, but I think what Michael is saying is that if Florida is crucial, Texas is even more crucial. And you're saying that you think that Perry is the only Republican that would carry Texas?
All those guys will win Texas. Romney would win Texas.
Everybody would win Texas, right.
None of the Democrats not going to win Texas, but you got to have Florida. You got to have Michigan and Ohio.
Thanks very much. You mentioned Michelle Bachmann. She is a prodigious fundraiser. Why? What's her secret? What's her magic? And clearly, she's not doing as well as Sarah Palin in the polls, but she's certainly doing much better than Sarah Palin in organizing and money raising and all the other things that a serious candidate should be doing.
Well, don't forget what Sarah Palin did in the 2010 cycle. She went around and stumped for, endorsed, raised money for a lot of candidates. So that's serious infrastructure building, too. People forget that in terms of building a national campaign. Bachmann, I think one of her secrets and why she is such a prodigious fundraiser and why she does get traction among the Tea Party folks is that she was one of the first congressmen to really take out after Obama and to put forward the bill of particulars against the president in no uncertain terms. And she did that creatively through national media outlets and in a very unvarnished way that I think has great resonance. And she translated that into great fundraising.
You'd love to run against her?
Oh, yeah. I'm a little concerned about the governor of Texas because he does sound like he has some Reagan-like qualities. But, yeah, bring on Michelle Bachmann and the lady from Alaska would be a dream come true for the White House.
All right. There you hear it. That's the liberal perspective, 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border, I'm Bruce Dumont taking America's political pulse, talking about what the Republicans might come up with next year. Again, everybody is, at least a lot of the pundits are saying, there's not much out there that gets exciting. Here's something I would like to hear. And last week on this program, we had a guest, Bruno Behrend, who was singing the praises of Tim Pawlenty, who announced for governor this week. I would like to hear from anyone out there listening who is a big fan of Tim Pawlenty's or a big fan of Mitt Romney's. For someone with a lot of money and who you would think would be doing a lot better, he's in second place, at least in one of his most recent polls. But it seems to me that Mitt Romney should have put this nomination away already. He hasn't done it. Everybody's looking for options. So if you like Romney or you like Pawlenty, tell us why. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics in this hour, featuring commentary by conservative Dan Propp, liberal John McCarron, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, coming to you from our new home at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in our brand new building on State Street, that great street in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289 if you'd like to email us a comment. Our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. We've got callers on the line. They're talking about who the Republican messenger might be for next year. But I would like to spend a few moments talking about what that message might be. Dan, you said in the first hour, you talked about Medicare and how it worked successfully for the Democrats in upstate New York. As you look into your crystal ball, what do you think will be the key issue that the Republican standard bearer is going to be focusing on virtually in each and every campaign address?
Well, I think it's about people's economic security issues. I think that's where this election will turn, as most do, particularly in a down economy like we continue to have. So whether that manifests itself in a discussion about debt ceilings or income tax rates or jobless claims or business growth and economic GDP growth, it's going to be about economic security issues. And I thought Shelby Steele had an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal this week, some good advice for the Republican Party in terms of presenting the larger contrast, the larger value proposition. And he essentially boiled it down to this. President Obama believes in big government. Every policy has a big government solution, and the Republican Party believes in you as the individual. And that's essentially the contrast that the Republican Party needs to present and then build the narrative underneath that rubric.
John McCarron, how do you see the political lines being drawn next year?
Well, other than to say that they're in Joplin, Missouri tonight, they're probably not complaining about big government. They're probably looking for a little more government help, but we'll be that as it may. You were talking about Medicare, and I kind of agree with you there. I hope the Democrats don't just keep hammering away at the Paul Ryan voucher plan. I saw Roger Simon in today's Chicago Sun-Times. He's syndicated, I think, out of Baltimore. He's probably in a lot of papers today, saying that seniors could end up having to ante up to $6,000 out of pocket along with their voucher to get coverage similar to, well, that's, you know, it's like $500 a month. So that's pretty scary. But I think the question, the fair question to ask is, okay, Democrats, if you think that's bad, and I happen to agree it is bad to do it that way, what's your plan?
That's what Bill Clinton said.
What's your plan? And I think we all have to grow up a little bit and realize we're talking about rationing here, the R word. And the way I read the president's health care bill, there would be panels of experts who would decide what's necessary and what isn't, what works and what doesn't. We don't want to be paying for extremely expensive patented medicines when maybe take two aspirin and go to bed might be just as well.
Does that, in your view, Charles Lipson, does that become the premier issue, the Medicare issue, or does it become jobs and other elements of economic debate?
I think that the biggest issue in the campaign is going to be Obama. I think beyond that, there are two economic issues and two health issues. The economic issue is one in the overall performance of the economy, and secondly, I believe the debt issue is a crucial issue, and it's gotten a lot of traction. I thought until a few weeks ago it was Obamacare under health was the one health issue, but I think that Dan and John are both right that the Medicare issue is now front and center. It's hard to say which of these is going to be the biggest. Shelby Steele's article was a really important article. He's saying it's time to draw a line between essentially Lyndon Johnson, Franklin D. Roosevelt, big government Democrats, and try to say that that's what Obama wants, and Reaganesque Republicans And say that that's their future.
But the discussion of the macro needs to be drilled down, needs to be translated down to quality of life. In other words, the quality of life that we have come to enjoy is slipping away. The quality of life that my parents enjoyed or that I enjoy is something that future generations are not going to have access to if we don't deal with these issues, including entitlement reform. And frankly, it's very clear, Peggy Noonan writes about this from the Peterson Foundation fiscal summit that happened earlier this week, that Gene Sperling, who is one of Obama's domestic policy mystics, they have no plan. They have and they have no interest in a plan. Their interest is strictly in demagoguing.
Kick the can down the road.
Demagoguing the Paul Ryan plan and demagoguing their own big government entitlement expansions like Obamacare.
Let's go to Colin listening to us in Champaign, Illinois on WLS. You're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Hello, sir. I was listening to you guys earlier, and I think Mitt Romney has some electability issues. Tim Pawlenty, I think, is someone who can bring together different sects of the base. He's been courting libertarians. He's a social conservative from a blue state. I think he can bring the party together. But then what also has been interesting this last week that you haven't heard people talk about is in the recent polls, the surge of Rudy Giuliani and Ron Paul, who aren't your lockstep conservative, but they seem to be really surging in the CNN polls and seem to be the two that fare the best against Obama. So I think maybe a Ron Paul or a Rudy Giuliani might get a second look from the establishment if electability is the biggest issue. But as long as this election's about health care, I don't think Mitt Romney has a shot, and people in the Midwest still remember those donations him and his wife made to Planned Parenthood, so I think he's got an uphill battle with social conservatives as well.
Damn. Well, I think you're right about Mitt Romney, and his speech in defense of RomneyCare a couple weeks ago in Michigan was disastrous, and it was completely tone deaf. So I agree with you that he's got that problem. The one thing I would say about national polls, though, is how irrelevant they are. And I'm not just saying that because we're 18 months out. I'm saying that because this isn't a national election. It's a state-by-state election. And so Rudy Giuliani may be at 16% of the polls, but he's nowhere in New Hampshire, and he's nowhere in Iowa, and he's nowhere in South Carolina, and that's why he's irrelevant as a potential candidate. You have to look at these state by state. So that's why Romney, to me, is the front runner, because he's dominating New Hampshire and he's going to win New Hampshire almost regardless of what the field is. And he's positioned well because of the infrastructure building he's done in addition to previously running to run to do the marathon that is the campaign state by state.
John.
Well, the caller says we need a libertarian and a social conservative to bring the party together. Guys, that's your problem. You need Nelson Rockefeller. You need George Romney. You need Chuck Percy. You need to get back to mainstream Republicanism and get off this this far-right bandwagon.
I love listening to a liberal tell us what mainstream Republicanism looks like.
Well, do you want to win or do you want to lose?
George Bush ran as a conservative, you'll recall. Even George Herbert Walker Bush ran as a conservative. Obviously, the greatest president of the 20th century was an unapologetic conservative. Republicans are at their best, both policy-wise and politically, electorally, when they embrace the conservative bedrock principles of the party.
I was unaware that FDR was a conservative, but go ahead.
I'm talking about Republicans winning.
I think he was talking about Reagan. You were talking about Roosevelt.
I was thinking
Roosevelt. I know the other are. 1-800-723-8289. When we come back, we're going to go to Knoxville, Tennessee. This guy not only has a favorite, he has the ticket ready. We'll find out what the ticket is. It'll get punched from Knoxville when we come back. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to Knoxville, Tennessee. Michael is listening to us on WNOX. Go ahead. You're on the air. You've got the ticket for the Republicans. Who is it?
Yes, sir. It's Rick Perry and Sarah Palin. You can't have any better two. You both got two which are known to be conservative. Both of them are able to work with a diverse group. You got Perry with the Mexicans and the Indians, Arapahoes, Navajos, Apaches. Sarah Palin had to work with the Inuit, the Eskimos. To some degree, the Russians. They both have
the Russians. What is she? because she could see them from her porch?
Well, yeah, you had a lot of trawlers come through Alaska, and besides, you can see them across the Bering Strait.
What do we think? Right,
we were put up to this by Tina Fey, weren't you?
Let's find out. Let's get reaction from Perry and Palin. Pee-pee.
I don't think that's going to be the ticket. I don't think Sarah Palin's going to be a vice presidential candidate again.
Been there, done that.
Yeah, but I'll
she's experienced, though.
Well, one thing I would say, there's an interesting profile piece on her in the most recent issue of The Atlantic that talks actually about her tenure as governor of Alaska, something she maybe doesn't talk about enough, and the very positive fiscal condition she left the state in.
How Indiana is the place? Go ahead. You're on the air, Luis. Luis, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hello?
Luis, are you there?
Yes, I am here, sir. How are you doing?
Okay, go ahead.
I am more excited about this year's race than I was on the race 2 years ago. I like the conservatives better on this race for the Republicans. I like Ron Paul the best. I do like the governor of Texas, but I think I would vote for Ron Paul before I vote for Rick Perry.
Why do you like Ron Paul?
Because he's a fiscal conservative. He wants to balance the budget tomorrow, not 10 years down the road.
I want to get reaction from everybody. Ron Paul consistently scores very well in the polls. He usually wins debates, at least according to the non-scientific analysis that usually follows debates.
He's not a lot of money.
He's not going to go away. And his supporters are dogged.
Yes.
In a multi-candidate race, could he pull a surprise?
No, I don't think so.
The establishment, under no circumstances, would let him.
I don't think so. And plus, you know, Ron Paul's also 75 years old now, too. So he's not the guy who showed up 20 years ago. I think he's great for the discussion. I think he expands the parameters of debate. And I think he's got a lot of good ideas. But is he going to be the Republican nominee? No.
He also wants to do away with the Federal Reserve Board. So I say bring him on.
Herman Cain is running better than some of the well-known people in the race, including Newt Gingrich, Michelle Bachmann, and Tim Pawlenty. He's got 10% in this most recent poll. Is he a serious candidate? Anybody?
He could be the one person who comes out of this current race and sort of does far better than expected, as Huckabee did last time. And he seems to have done a very credible job in presenting himself.
Will there be a black Republican vice president?
I think it's quite unlikely that he would be on the ticket.
I think it's unlikely, too, although, and maybe not this cycle, but there's others that are interesting, too, including Alan West, the congressman from Florida. Cain is a serious guy who's got a great narrative, and he's an accomplished individual. And I think his support not just speaks to the strength of the Tea Party, but it also speaks to the desire for new faces in the Republican Party.
So you believe that a Republican African-American is a possibility in 2012?
I think it's a possibility. I think it's unlikely, but it's possible.
Gene, listening to us in Chicago, wants Mitt Romney in the race. Why?
Oh, I've always wanted Romney to be president because I think this is his time. He's the man of the hour. We've been round and round with this, again and again. And I do think he's a wonderful politician. He can stand toe-to-toe with Obama and make a wonderful appearance, and I think he can handle any and all rebuttals. Also, you know, I heard once some time ago that the tallest man always wins the presidency.
I think that's the reason Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is running this year. I believe this
caller is correct.
That's right.
I believe that is a complete harbinger of who wins.
Causation versus correlation.
I think it's always been that way. That's why Mitch Daniels really dropped out.
Too
sure. Nothing
it certainly explains Dennis Kucinich's problem.
Has nothing to do with his wife.
The problem that Romney has is that there are two big economic issues and there are two big health care issues. He does great on the economic issues. He can put those forward. He'll have a lot of trouble on the health care issues.
And he could have said, I'm sorry, but he didn't. Let's go to Joe. He's a Obama supporter, and you're laughing all the way to re-election, aren't you, Joe?
Oh, absolutely, Bruce. How you doing, Bruce? How you doing, panel?
I'm doing fine. How are you, Joe?
Because none of these guys actually scare me. I mean, Mitt Romney, give me a break. The guy's the biggest flip-flopper in the race. Tim Pawlenty? You mean Mr. Excitement? Come on. Ron Paul? The only one that really scared me, to be honest with you guys, was Mike Huckabee. Because I think he could have been competitive.
Likeable.
And Sarah Palin, first of all, I don't think she's going to run. Bill Kristol mentioned that today on Fox News that he don't think she's going to run. And this is the same guy who praised her about 3 years ago. And that motorcycle group that I guess she had a bus tour today.
Rolling Thunder. She was.
They didn't even want her there. I mean, you know, but the thing is, and Michelle Bachmann. I mean, I'm not calling her this, but a lot of people think she's a nutcase. I mean, bring it on. All these people. But right. Obama will beat all of them.
He's not going to call her a nutcase.
I mean, you've got to be kidding. the Republicans have to be absolutely kidding. Come on.
I think you're right that Huckabee would have been a very strong candidate.
I think Huckabee,
candidate.
Right. As a Democrat, he's the one that I would really have been afraid of, Mike Huckabee. As a matter of fact, if Mike Huckabee would have shows up Mitch Daniels, I would have been a little, yeah.
Joe, thanks very much. John Hutzman, former governor of Utah, ambassador to China, appointed by Barack Obama, is the latter credential the kiss of death in a Republican primary? Because at least it seems to me that the inside the Beltway media seems to keep propping this guy up.
Oh, well,
he's got $500 million, so you don't have to be propped up too much.
Yeah,
he's
a smart guy. He speaks Mandarin. I mean, in terms of the greatest economic – well, no, but I'm saying in terms of the greatest economic competitor to the U.S. in the 21st century, he knows a lot about China. But so, you know, I think he's got some credentials. Is the fact that he was Obama's ambassador to China problematic? I think it's highly problematic, yes.
Sarah Palin was asked about China. She said, not on a blue tablecloth. Did you hear that? Let's go to Dominic in Austin, Texas, on KLBJ.
Yeah, I think the only person that stands any chance against Obama is Congressman Ron Paul from Texas. He's been nominated 10 times for Congress. He's a champion of the Constitution, and he'd have Obama searching for his teleprompters.
He'd get 41% of the vote. He'd get 41% of the vote, and if he hit everything right, he'd get 42%.
Are you worried about his age?
Not at all. He actually he works out every morning. He's very fit. He actually has a son that's senator of Kentucky who's young who could take up right after him if Ron Paul can't make it.
That's not the way. That's North Korea. That's Chicago.
That's
not the way it happens.
Let me ask the
you
caller.
Just can't let your son do it.
Let me ask the caller. Do you want to abolish the Federal Reserve?
Of course, the Federal Reserve is a private organization which was set up in 1913 in Congress, and they did it mysteriously, and they still run this United States. It's a giant Ponzi scheme that's set on the American people that's putting this country into the dirt.
Thank you.
Does there need? Thanks very much. Can there be? Can a campaign ever be a teaching moment, or does it have to be about three issues and sound bites and that's it, John?
One would hope it could be an issue moment. That's why I'm nagging the Democrats to come up with their own Medicare cost containment program. But when you listen to a lot of talk radio and you see in Fox News and the other MSNBC, when you see the kind of glib condemnations that are made, someone couldn't run for president because he exhibited bipartisanship in taking an ambassadorship for a Democratic administration. I mean, that's insane. I mean, that is not a sophisticated way to approach public policy.
I think if campaigns turn into a teaching moment, they're losing campaigns. It's like a friend told me, if you are talking with a lawyer and a lawyer says to you, this raises interesting constitutional questions, you're in deep legal trouble.
So we're condemned to be a Dancing with the Stars nation here.
I am much more sanguine about it than these two gentlemen. I have to say, maybe despite John's previous admonition to me, I have more faith in the American people than he thinks I do. But I think they can be a teaching moment. I think it's going to need to be, and you're going to have spokesmen for the important issues, the transformative policy choices that need to be made, like Paul Ryan out there. And to the extent that the Republicans corner the market on those type of individuals with serious long-term plans for how you write the fiscal ship of state, I think it's going to behoove the Republicans.
Could Paul Ryan enter the race? Could Paul Ryan be if he's going to define the message, why should he not be the messenger?
because I think he likes being the chairman of the House Budget Committee. But would he have potential? Would he have potential? Could he potentially get traction as a presidential candidate? Yeah, I think he could. Mm-hmm. I think he could, and he's a national figure now.
He would raise the key issue for the Republicans is actually the fiscal issues. I think if it turns into a social issues campaign, I think it'll be very hard for the Republicans. And I think if it turns into an extremist economic issues around the libertarian side of Ron Paul and so forth, I think the Republicans are toast.
Well, let's also, when we come back, we've been talking about, you know, how solid the Republican base will be. When we come back, I'm going to hear from John McCarron. I want to talk about how solid is that left of center base for Barack Obama. A lot of well-known liberals in recent days have said some very uncomplimentary things about Barack Obama, including Cornel West. We want to hear from him on that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. Also in the next segment, next or before we go off the air this evening, we want to spend some time talking about our good friend, the late Tom Roser. From Anchorage, Alaska to Birmingham, Alabama, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway, coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night. Tonight coming to you live from the new Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. And again, as I mentioned last week on this program, on the 16th of June, we are going to have a sneak preview open house. It is a benefit for the museum. Tickets are $150, and again, it'll be a great opportunity for those that have been following this story for the last, seems like about 80 years of my life, but certainly the last 5 years with the trials and tribulations. It's a beautiful new building. We moved into the offices last Monday. We are doing our first broadcast from the studios this evening. We'll do our first television show from here next Sunday night, but again, the benefit is on Thursday, the 16th of June, and you can go to museum.tv if you'd like to purchase tickets. Museum.tv will have a lot of artifacts out, a lot of samples of what the museum will be when we finish and prepare to open sometime later this year.
I'm going to be one of those artifacts, but there are going to be other people
well, I
there,
hope you're
Bruce.
Going to be there, too.
I am going to be there. I've already got my ticket, but explain some of the big names who are going to be there.
Well, the big names for those involved in politics, we will have the governor of Illinois, Pat Quinn. We will have the mayor of the city of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel. And we will have the Senate president, John Cullerton. And there's a lot of other stars of radio and television that will also be joining us. So we've got several hundred people already signed up. So it'll be a great night. They'll be able to wander the entire museum. And again, you know, historically, you know, if you turn back the clock and you grew up in Chicago and you think of the great museums in this city, and we have some of the greatest popular museums in the country, think of turning back the clock 50 or 60 or 80 years ago if you would have been able to walk in that museum on the very first, you know, on the cusp of its opening. What an exciting thing it could be for you and your children and grandchildren in years to come. So that's what we built here. Again, thanks to the support from the state of Illinois and the taxpayers of Illinois, we've built a beautiful building. We're not ready to open our doors yet, but we will open them on June 16th for a sneak preview open house, museum.tv. Wherever you're listening, if you love radio, television, history, or you're a Chicagoan and you want to support a good cause, museum.tv. Let's go to John, listening to us in Chicago on WLS. Go ahead.
Government-subsidized boondoggle. Hey, if the Republicans cannot get across the fact that Paul Ryan comes up and says, we are going to reform Medicare, if you are involved in it, no changes. If you are 55, no changes. After that, you're going to have to produce a little bit more into the system. If the Republican Party cannot get that across, that there are going to be no changes, and they're going to hand the discussion over to the Democrats about death panels, push granny over the cliff, then we don't deserve this country. We don't deserve the set the debate, and let it all go bankrupt, and let's pick up the pieces in 12 years where no one has anything, and the baby boomers are, you know, working in soup kitchens. Let it all go to hell. Because if you can't let a guy like Paul Ryan come up
and just simply state some facts and figures and have a plan and have to go up with scumbags like Schumer, Pelosi, Clinton caught on tape saying one thing and then addressing another. Get over it.
All right, John. John, you're making the point which I asked in the last segment, and that is, in a presidential election, can it be a teaching moment? Can someone spend some time, day in, day out, in every speech, in every newscast, to convince and teach the American people and to explain to them a plan that to some is complicated, that will affect their lives, that will change their lives? Obviously, he's arguing in the positive, and it's good for the country. Can you do that?
I think John is confusing with his death panels thing. That was a Republican coinage. That was Sarah Palin saying that President Obama's health plan, which would set up these expert panels to decide what works and what doesn't and what's a waste of money and what isn't. She called those death panels. So that was a Republican scare. That wasn't a Democratic scare.
Well, the issue here I'm sorry, go ahead, Charles. The issue here is that because Ryan's plan involves vouchers and therefore imposes some uncertainty and potential costs on people, the way that the Republicans not only have to explain that, but they have to show that the current system is unsustainable. If they can't convince people that the alternative, that they're not taking a system that'll work and is doing just fine and can continue forever and are going to replace it, if that's what people think the alternative is, the Republicans lose. They have to absolutely show that the current system is unsustainable.
And I think the Democrats will help them explain that.
Well, that's why I have hope for the Paul Ryan discussion and maybe even improvements on the plan that he proposes, because I think there is a recognition and, frankly, largely a concession that the Medicare in its current iteration is unsustainable. I think that's something that you have wide agreement on. So now if you accept that premise, that forces this conversation. Okay, if this is unsustainable, then what is sustainable on a go-forward
basis?
Then my question, in this teaching moment of what 2012 can be, I go back to you, John, and ask for your follow-up to the question I asked before the break, and that is, where are the progressives? Where are the liberals? How much leeway are they going to give to the president? Because there are many liberals who think that he sold out, that he should have gone for a single-payer plan, and they, too, I would think, just as many on the right, they would like to see a real knockdown, drag-out discussion and have let winner take all.
Oh, there'll be a knockdown, drag-out discussion. First of all, Bruce, where are they going to go? You know, Dennis Kucinich. I mean, there is no one else on the left who would.
But there is an enthusiasm level. Well, if the enthusiasm is not there, you can lose elections on intensity.
That's true. You can.
And where you lose elections.
The folks on the left, they do have a bill of particulars. They're, most recently, this year's federal budget that went to the 11th hour. There were cuts to domestic urban renewal kind of programs that
they don't like the wars, and they don't like Gitmo.
They don't like the wars. They wanted the public plan. It was dropped as a compromise. They want the Justice Department to go after the subprime lenders instead of insider traders that hardly anyone has ever heard of. I mean, let's go after the people who really helped put us in the ditch that we're on now.
Cornel West said he's a puppet of Wall Street.
I wouldn't go that far. You know what he is? And I think maybe we know him here in Chicago better than Cornel West. He's a negotiator, an organizer, and a compromiser. You could almost see him allowing himself to be beaten up by Mr. Netanyahu in Israel, that he was almost like wincing like a beat dog, like a puppy being whipped, realizing that by going passive with Netanyahu and letting Netanyahu be the alpha male there in that press availability, that he was actually scoring some points.
Well, I'll tell you what, when we talk about what this election turns on, which is most do, especially at the national level, that persuadable middle independents who have who Obama has hemorrhaged over the last 24 months, they are not going to accept, I think, and treat people as serious if the economy is still in very tough as it is now. Right. And congressional Democrats in the Obama administration do not propose a budget They do not propose an alternative vision for entitlement reform. That is not acceptable to have no plan going forward if you're the chief executive of the nation.
I don't think that this is a right call about Obama being passive in all of this. Netanyahu, just to take that one example, Netanyahu was flying to Washington to sort of assume that there was going to be a good set of talks, and then on the Thursday, just before he got on the airplane, he was sandbagged by Obama coming in and making an ill-thought-out speech at the State Department that basically set up a negotiating parameters that had not been set up before. Obama announced that was an important departure. When he got pushback, what he then said was, "I didn't say anything new." I don't actually know whether Obama's a compromiser. When he may have gotten criticism from the left about the stuff on health care, but he pushed through as hard a program as he could possibly push. He did it over Rahm Emanuel's advice, and he did it without any support from the other party. He got as much as he could possibly get. I think he's naive on some things. I think saying, "I'm going to close Guantanamo," before he got any agreement on where to put the people, was simply naivete.
Has he been hurt badly within the Jewish community?
Yes, he's been hurt badly, but the Jewish community is extremely liberal, and they're not. There has been a question for the last 30 years when the Jewish community would vote its income and not its values, social liberal values. And so it may hurt him a bit on fundraising, but the Jewish community is much more committed to the domestic social issues than it is to his policies in the Middle East.
Is there likely to be much time spent on foreign affairs, in your view, Dan?
Well, I think that, look, with the situation in Libya, with the quote-unquote Arab Spring and what that will portend, and to the extent that we continue to have stories, even though they're not on the front page, or there was a story this week about seven U.S. soldiers killed in Afghanistan. I mean, that stuff is still very real, and it's not going away. And to the extent that we have men and women in harm's way across the world, particularly in the Arab world, that is going to be maybe not central, but it's going to be very important.
And let us all remember them tomorrow on this Memorial Day weekend. Remember those that have paid the ultimate sacrifice for the country they love. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly for some final comments about Tom Roser. Last week on this program, we announced to our listeners all over the country something that those who listen to our flagship station, WLS Radio, knew, and that was that our good friend and the gentleman that followed us every Sunday night on our flagship station, Tom Roser, was retiring from radio. The news we bring you tonight is that Tom Roser has passed away. He passed away last evening. He's left his wife, Lillian, and their family and grandchildren. And around the table with us this evening, we have some people that know him, and we'll hear from a couple of people who have called in. Dan Proft, you represent sort of the new era of conservative commentator in this market, on this radio station, WLS, and on Beyond the Beltway. And for those longtime listeners, they remember that Tom Roser was on the very first program we did back in June of 1980, and a friend of mine since 1974. But Tom Roser had a special place in the in your life, and also in the life of anyone who considers themselves a conservative.
Well, Tom Roser was the godfather of conservatism, particularly in the Chicagoland area. I mean, he was one of the lone voices in the wilderness for many, many years. He paved the way for, you know, people like me to have opportunities in radio as well. There's no doubt about that. And he was the thing I think about Tom Roser, I recall what Goethe wrote, the German writer, who said that to think is easy, to act is hard, but the hardest thing in the world is to act in accordance with your thinking. And that's what Tom Roser did. He lived what he professed, not just as conservative values, but also as a great leader in the Catholic community in the Chicagoland area. And you just have to have tremendous respect for the contributions he made. And my first interaction with him, just to tell a brief story and to highlight what I'm saying, is a couple years after I graduated from Northwestern University. And the the administration there tried to eliminate a conservative weekly newspaper that we had started on campus when I was an undergrad. And when Tom Roser got wind of this, he was writing a column for the Chicago Sun-Times at the time, and he took up our cause in the interests of academic freedom and combating political correctness. We ultimately also got Charlton Heston involved, who wrote a letter to the president, who was went to Northwestern, who wrote a letter to the Northwestern president at the time, Arnie Weber. And ultimately, one of my first appearances on radio, as awkward as this is, Tom Roser on his radio show on WLSN Saturday morning at the time, Charlton Heston, and me. So, you know, which one of these pieces does not fit? But that was Tom Roser. And so then I had been on his show a number of times and got to know him over the years from that initial interaction. And he was just a great American, and it's a terrible loss.
John McCarron, you were on the other side of the political aisle, but you tangled with Tom from time to time.
I was. We disagreed on a lot of things, but I go back since when he was a PR guy here in Chicago for Quaker Oat Company, I believe. And two things about Tom that I will have enormous respect for, always will. One is his undying support of a homeless shelter on the Near West Side run by Catholic Charities. He just couldn't do enough for that. So. You can be conservative and have a huge heart, too.
He was compassionate.
Be interested in the plight of people of have-nots. The other thing that he helped put together is something called the City Club of Chicago, which is a biweekly public affairs luncheon gathering. And it's really one of the few places, you know, you don't have to be a member. You just go, you pay a small fee that it's almost a good deal for the lunch itself, and they have politicians and other political experts and public affairs experts. And it's one of the really nice things about Chicago public dialogue.
Two guests on the phone join us now. Cliff Kelly, morning talk show host on WVON. Afternoon, I'm sorry, Cliff. Also a first guest on the very first Inside Politics show. And again, not only on the air, but every Thursday night at dinner for about 12 years, the three of us would go out, and it would be quite an experience.
Listen, I have thanked you before, Bruce Dumas, for putting me on Inside Politics, which led to a lot of other things, as you well know. But I also have to thank you for letting me get to know Tom Roser. The gentleman was just a great man. And notwithstanding, everybody talked about him being a conservative. You heard many of the conversations we had at dinner. And we used to get along on a lot of things. Of course, we had a disagreement on a number of things, mm-hmm. but I think he was great. And as was mentioned, a lot of the things that he did, you remember this, he was running the Park Ridge for voters for Roland Burris. Remember that?
Oh, yeah, no, he did a lot of stuff. Also, a person that wants to say a word is Chris Roebling, also a political commentator and a talk show host, now in public affairs. But again, also, I think, an early mentee of Tom Roser.
It's absolutely right, Bruce. Thank you for having me on. 30 years, I had the privilege of knowing Tom. You look back, picking up on what Dan said, putting his thoughts into action. Tom, he actually kept the lights on at the City Club, John McCarron. That started 105 years ago. Without Tom Roser, it would be gone. The Republican Assembly of Illinois was a warm hearth for conservatives during a period when there just was no home in Illinois Republicanism for conservatives. The Haymarket Center, John McCarron mentioned, it's still doing great work, and he's working. He worked very hard up until his very last days on Haymarket issues. Project Leap, if you remember, legal elections in all precincts.
Right.
And Tom was on a bipartisan board at Project Leap in the 70s and the 80s, long before hearing about election administration was fashionable. Just an extraordinary person, a wonderful public man, and of course we had the privilege of getting to know the private person that synced up beautifully with what we saw in public. Thank you very much.
I also think that, again, to underscore, you know, what Cliff alluded to, you know, for 15 years, Tom Roser was a regular on this program. Every Thursday night, this is when we were on WBEZ and Thursday nights, every Thursday night we would go out to dinner. It was usually all the guests, and the raucous on-the-air show became even more raucous when we had dinner. And I will say that insofar as fun is concerned and insofar as an educational experience, I don't think I've had more fun or more of an educational experience in my entire adult life than the time I spent with Tom Roser. He was a great friend, I will miss him. He will be in the memory of this program and this reporter forever. Tom Roser, we love you. See you next week.